3 in Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Forget about a colorblind society. That politically correct utopia does not exist. Race is real. Race is powerful. Race is good, says Harvard Law School professor Lonnie Guinier. It's time, she says, to shift away from the old black and white ruts of racial misunderstanding and embrace a bold, new technicolor model that starts with race to unite the disenfranchised of all colors. In this hour, re-examining the way we look at race, Lonnie Guinier's vision of political race and how it could transform democracy. In her new book, co-authored with Gerald Torres, The Miner's Canary, tonight's guest Lonnie Guinier makes the case that race is more than skin deep. Let's not pretend otherwise, she says. Let's acknowledge race, she says, then rally people of all colors who are struggling in this land of plenty to make a decent wage, get an education, gain access to health care. Are you ready to give up on the colorblind society? Do you define yourself by race or by something else? Can disadvantaged Americans embrace race and move ahead together? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio is Lonnie Guinier. Good evening and welcome, Lonnie Guinier.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And with us from Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Lonnie Guinier, a lot of us have spent a lifetime trying or thinking that we've been trying to get beyond race. And here you come with a big book, The Miner's Canary, and you say, no, no, we have to embrace race. Start us off right there. Why? We thought that as a nation the project was to get beyond it. You're saying get real, it can't be done, let's go back. Well, what is it about?
Well, Gerald Torres and I are not saying at some point, we shouldn't get beyond race. But in order to do that, you have to start with race. And the reason to start with race is that race is like the canary in the mines. The miners used to take a canary into the mines to alert them when the atmosphere in the mines was too toxic for the miners. And the canary had a more fragile respiratory system that would give way, signaling that there was a problem with the atmosphere in the mines. And we're saying that race, that the experience of people of color is like the canary. And problems converge around people of color. The problems are made visible because they are identified with people of color. But in order to fix those problems, we have to fix the atmosphere in the mind. So we start with the canary, but the goal is to start with race to be able to identify problems that are otherwise invisible.
So you're saying that the country's problems congregate around racial minorities? And therefore, if you look at the problems of racial minorities, you will be looking at the distilled problems of the nation?
That is absolutely correct. That oftentimes things affect people of color first, but that doesn't mean that they will only affect people of color.
But the civil rights... I'm sorry, Lonnie.
That's okay.
The civil rights movement seemed to say, well, if we get rid of racial barriers, if we get rid of racism, then we will share the problems and the benefits of our society equally. Wasn't that the goal?
Well, I think there were many goals in the civil rights movement, and it's interesting that we call it a civil rights movement. If you go down to Mississippi and you talk to some of the black people who were involved in that movement, they say it was a freedom movement. And it was not just about obtaining rights for specific black people. It was really about freeing America as well as people of color. Dr. King often said that by freeing the Negro, America will be freeing itself as well. So this is a transformative vision that's not just about ensuring specific rights for individuals, although obviously that's important. This is trying to say that's not enough and that we have to transform patterns or practices that not only affect and disadvantage people of color, but also affect and disadvantage working class and poor whites. But the effect and the disadvantage as it is experienced by working class whites is often not noticeable. And so in order to see that effect, you have to start with race.
So there's the problem. Now take us through your prescription, your thesis here. You want to start with race. That means, hey, don't try to be colorblind. Embrace your race. Find communities of race. And go from there? What's the program?
Okay. Well, first of all, this is not so much a program as an operating system. We had a wonderful symposium.
All right. I'll call Bill Gates and ask him the difference, but okay.
Well, Urvashi Vaid, who's an activist in the area of lesbian and gay rights, said, what Gerald and I have come up with is really an operating system that is suggesting we have to rethink the framework, but that it's up to other people to come up with the applications, to come up with the software.
But I do read, you are suggesting blacks, let's say, recognize yourself as a community and use that racial unity of that community to form a political building block for change. Isn't that right? So aren't you saying that Americans should get together around racial communities to begin a process of political empowerment?
Well, we're saying that often what is noticeable, because it affects racialized communities, is an asset. That is, race is a diagnostic tool because it helps us see patterns that are otherwise invisible. But we are not saying that this is just about conventional notions of race as biology or ancestry or who your parents are. We are really using race as a verb, not a noun. We're saying...
Oh, now you're stretching our minds. What do you mean there? A foot race in that case?
No, not a foot race, but a political race. That we're really saying, if you see problems and they are affecting people of color first, look closely, because they may be affecting working class and poor whites as well, and then unite across race to fix those problems in a way that may have to change the structure, not just the people who are admitted into those institutions.
You write that the rhetoric of colorblindness can be deployed to polarize, marginalize, or distract a multiracial coalition from forming and pursuing a social justice agenda. So are you saying that colorblindness, which many of us have thought of as one of the goals of the civil rights movement, you're suggesting it has actually become a tool of powerful elements in society to keep others down? Pick that apart for us.
Well, let me give you a concrete example. Colorblindness was the rhetoric of the Fifth Circuit decision in the Hopwood case in Texas. The Fifth Circuit said that the University of Texas had to admit all of its students using a colorblind notion of merit. And the case was brought by a white working-class woman, Cheryl Hopwood, who challenged the admission of 63 out of 92 black and Latino students on the grounds that they had not scored as high as she had on some of the entry-level tests. Mm-hmm. Turns out there were also 140 white students that had not scored as high as she had on those same tests, but they were admitted at the same time she was rejected. Colorblindness said, we're only going to look at the 63 out of 92 black and Latino students. We're not going to look at what's happening with the way the University of Texas is admitting everybody that may be disadvantaging not only Cheryl Hopwood, but other working class and poor whites, because in the name of colorblindness and in the name of merit, the school was using a set of aptitude tests and equations that essentially gave credit to privilege. In other words, if you went to Harvard, if you went to Yale, and then from there you applied to the University of Texas, and they counted the LSAT scores of the other kids who had gone to Harvard and had gone to Yale at the same time you did, and it turns out the LSAT correlates with class. Within each race and ethnic group, as your parental income goes up, so do your SAT scores, your ACT scores, your GRE scores, your MCAT scores. And what was happening is that Cheryl Hopwood had gone to a state and a community college, and that fact had brought down her Texas index, because the students at her school came from working class and poor families, didn't do as well on the LSAT. That pulled down her scores. So what's the solution? Well, basically, we're saying, in Texas, they came up with a 10% plan at the undergraduate level.
That's right.
They discovered that this problem of class, which they didn't realize until they were looking at it through the lens of race, was a problem that gave 75% of the freshman seats at the University of Texas Austin, the flagship school, to 10% of the high schools in Texas. So there are 150 high schools dominating 75% of the seats, although there are 1,500 high schools throughout the state.
But wasn't there another 10% here? Didn't they ask the university ultimately to admit the top 10% of any high school class wherever?
And they were able to do that, and they got that 10% plan passed through the Texas legislature with the vote of a white conservative Republican legislator from rural West Texas, because he discovered that the same admission criteria that were keeping out blacks and Latinos were keeping out his constituents, so that he hadn't had anyone from his community go to the University of Texas either.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, Lani Guinier is giving us a little bit of a mind-twisting re-examination of race and how we use it. She says, let's not be afraid of it. Let's put race to work. That used to feel like a third rail, didn't it?
Well, it did, but I think that paradigm she gives of the disadvantage to people who just weren't as well born as others is well taken. But characteristically, you know, in America, we've said for years the way to get the discussion away from race is to talk about class, to say that the things that are hurting, you know.
We may have lost Jack there, but I think his
point. To white parents. But it's the problems of the black poor. Well, those problems are really a lot like the problems of the white poor. Therefore, to emphasize race, the standard progressive critique has been, you weaken the chances of making common cause across racial lines. Better by far to talk about class, and that therefore political race, her concept, would be more, binding if it were called class.
How about that, Lani Guinier? Jack Beattie, you dropped out for just a second there, but I think we got the gist of it, that if you're going to look for ways to rally the disenfranchised, the disadvantaged, why not a colorblind approach to that? The traditional word is class. Why not just rally around class-related issues? If you introduce race into this equation, don't you introduce the possibility of division along racial lines that could weaken the very people you're trying to help?
Well, there's several responses. First of all, race is polarizing. There's no doubt about it. But on the other hand, the people who are often the most energetic, the most easily mobilized, the people who are, quote unquote, the most reliable Democrats are people of color, particularly blacks. They often have a critique. 70%, for example, of black Americans, according to statistics put together by Michael Dawson, who's chair of the political science department at the University of Chicago, 70% of blacks think that the system is unfair to blacks and also unfair to poor people. That's a very strong, powerful group that could be mobilized. But if you don't talk about race, you often lose those people because they feel you're not talking to them. Secondly, if you only talk about class, that's often invisible. That's exactly what the problem was at the University of Texas. Those SATs and LSATs that were being held up as the symbol of merit had a disparate effect on working class and poor whites, but nobody noticed that effect until the black and Latino professors and legislators and advocates started looking at the use of the LSAT or the SAT to keep out students of color. Mm-hmm. So it becomes a really important tool to both mobilize people and to develop a critique that makes what is presently invisible visible so that we can see it and do something about it.
What's interesting, implicit in what you're saying here is a kind of readiness, a kind of, it seems like almost confidence, that in the United States of this decade, you can reintroduce race as a rallying point without bringing back the terrible kinds of race conflicts that have plagued this nation in the past. Are you so confident of that? Might you actually recreate in this effort the very divisions and even violence that we've seen in years past?
Well, we're not, first of all, reintroducing race because we're arguing race is there. The reason that the 10% plan was put on the table is because of the fact that people of color were not getting into the schools. So okay. We're not responsible for reintroducing race. We're essentially acknowledging the role that race is already playing.
So this is real politic in a way, you're saying.
Right. We're saying race tracks power. And if you want to understand power, then look at race. And if you want to understand and then change the way resources are distributed, start with race because you'll have a mobilized group of people. But then the challenge, and you're right, it's a challenge, but we're optimistic, is to move from race to issues of gender, to issues of class, to issues of distribution of resources, to tell a different story.
But it sounds like at Lani Guinier's political convention, the people might be sitting by color.
No.
Okay, we're going to come back. We're going to keep on this. We're talking with Lani Guinier about a new view of race and its utility in political terms. Do you agree? Has America failed at being racially blind, colorblind? And if we can't be blind to race, how should we deal with it? Do you identify yourself by race, by skin color? Could a transracial coalition of the poor, black, white, and brown, be the basis for a new progressive politics? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Lonnie Guinier, Harvard Law School professor, about a new view of race. She's out with a new book along with Gerald Torres. It's entitled The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. It's a challenging thesis. Do you agree? Has America failed at being racially blind? Have we wasted time trying to erase race? Can racial identification actually lead to greater justice, to greater unity in America? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lee is on the line. Welcome, Lee. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Tom?
We're well, Lee. Thanks.
Yep, and you're my brother, and Lonnie's my sister. And here's the thing. I just say we're all 50th cousins.
And what do you mean by that, Lee?
Well, we are. We're 50th cousins, all of us.
Well, hello, cousin. You mean that we're all related? So you're wanting to look beyond race in that case, or are we 50th cousins of different races?
No, inclusive. We are all on this planet 50th cousins of each other, whether we want to admit it or not. I very much do want to admit it. We are all cousins of each other.
So how do you feel about using the vocabulary, the perspective of race, to rally people to political ends?
To rally people to political ends, I applaud. But I really don't know if it's even just semantics to say race. We're all human beings. We are all so connected that I just wonder if there isn't a different way to talk about our color differences, our eye color difference, our hair, texture difference, but not race. I just wonder about that.
Lee, that's a great point, and Lord knows we spent a long time yearning and trying to be beyond those indicators. Lonnie Guinier, the point Lee raises goes right to a very interesting part of your book. Maybe you'll share it with us. It's the most personal part of your book, where you write about your son being educated in a very liberal school where he's taught explicitly and implicitly not to think about race, and about the education that you decided you needed to give him. Share that with us.
Well, my son was educated in a Quaker school. This is in Philadelphia. And he was watching me type on the computer, and I was describing someone who had come up to me and asked me to sign a picture. This was a well-dressed black woman who said if she had a signed picture, she would put it up in her office and nobody would mess with her. And
the power of Lonnie Guinier.
No, the power of a picture.
All right.
And my son came up and he said, Mom, take out the word black. As I had said, a well-dressed black woman. Mm-hmm. And I said, why? And he said, well, because it doesn't matter what color she is. I said, well, then should I take out the word woman? Because it doesn't matter that she was a woman. He said, no, you have to leave in the word woman because there's still sexual abuse. And so,
how old was he roughly at the time?
He was 8.
Okay, all right.
And
the liberal education began early. Its imprint was clear. So this is a fascinating moment. So how did you respond?
So he said, "Let me demonstrate." And he's we're in my office at home, and he then moves to his bedroom. He has me sit on the bed, and he's walking down the street, and he says, "Now, Mom, if I walked up to you and I started to touch you inappropriately, that would be wrong. That would be sexual abuse." And at that point, I felt really torn because on the one hand, he was being taught that there were issues of gender that were relevant to his life, but he was also being taught by these well-intentioned Quakers that in order to deal with issues of race, he had to ignore them. And so I said to him, well, Nico, let me see if I can show you racial abuse. And again, I was torn because I didn't want to scare him.
Yeah.
But I said, okay, let's replay that scene. We're walking down the street, and I'm passing you, and instead of touching you, I assault you verbally, and I say, you nasty, dirty nigger.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, oh, my God, Mom, you just made me feel that I wish I was white.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that that was an inadequate way to have him grow up feeling that if we were to talk about race, that the only choice was to either be silent or to wish that he was white.
Which is a way of saying you wanted him to identify with a racial group.
Well,
the very thing Lee is saying, that we're all 50th cousins and she'd like to see us Turn a blind eye to.
No, I wanted him to be able to participate in this society as a confident and informed member of the society who would be prepared to be profiled by the police, who might be prepared to be followed in stores, but not to internalize that and think, well, I just wish I were white. That would be the solution. And so part of this is driven by the notion that race is stigmatizing, but there is also a community of people of color that have developed not only solidarity, but critique, and have a sense of perspective that what is affecting them is not just internalized, but is a lens of looking at injustice. That's the point of that 70% statistic, that the system may be unfair to blacks, but it's also unfair to poor people.
We get the lens, but I guess I feel an old fear of this identification around racial polls, just because we know what that was like when that was the law of the land, and it was rough. We're talking with Lonnie Guinier about a new view of race. Her new book is The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. Can Americans simultaneously be more race aware and more effective at working together politically? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Diane's on the line. Welcome, Diane. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
Ms. Guinier, I admire your writing, but I'm not quite clear about what you're saying. If I'm interpreting you correctly, what you're saying is that, let's say you have a group of poor, exploited black workers, they could coalesce and be active and then eventually join together with poor, exploited white workers in order to affect change. Is that what you're saying?
That
or
is
something to that effect?
Yes, and in fact, in one of the chapters in the book, we tell a story of a Kmart plant in Greensboro, North Carolina, in which it was a 65% black plant, and Kmart was paying its workers $5.65 an hour less than it was paying workers at comparable production plants throughout the state. And remember, it's 65% black, so not all of the workers are black. White workers are also being paid $5.65 an hour less. And the group that was first to organize around this unfairness were the black workers. But they had an enlightened minister who said, we're going to start with race because these black workers understand what's happening, and they would meet in their church, and they would sing songs, and they would develop their confidence to go out and peacefully and nonviolently protest by going to the Kmart plant and praying. And soon, white workers began to join them. The white workers would meet in their union hall and sing union songs and then join the protest. And Kmart eventually retaliated and sued only the black workers, and they had also joined force with some black ministers and sued the black workers and ministers for trespass. And at that moment, the white workers came forward and held a press conference and demanded to know why they had not been sued too, because after all, they were part of this struggle. And that's the image, that it may start with the energy of black workers who notice the injustice and have a language for talking about it, but it has to eventually include the white workers who are willing to link their fate with the black workers to transform the situation to benefit all of them.
Diane, what do you make of that, race as a starting point politically?
My question, I guess, then, is hasn't this been tried before? Okay, in the case of the Kmart workers, yes, they bonded together, and the whites appeared to hold fast with the black workers. However, I seem to remember in my history, not the history that I learned in school, of course, but in my history, that there have been efforts to form coalitions between, say, poor whites and poor blacks. And in those cases, race tended to trump everything, so that poor whites still would rather embrace their whiteness than to, in fact, see how much they actually have in common with poor blacks.
No, I think you're
That's a great point, Diane. Thank you for making it.
I think
Lonnie
you're absolutely right. And that is a story that needs to be told, not because the white workers were invariably racist, but often because, and here's an example from Alabama in the beginning of the 1900s, they adopted a new constitution expressly to disenfranchise blacks. Mm-hmm. But one of their defenses, when that constitutional provision was challenged in the 1980s because they disenfranchised people based on crimes that they thought blacks were more likely to commit, and they admitted that they had done so because of race, their defense was, well, we also disenfranchised poor whites too. And the argument that they were making is, in order to disenfranchise blacks, we also had to disenfranchise some poor and illiterate whites. And our point is, well, that's exactly why we have to understand race, because we notice the disenfranchisement of blacks. We haven't noticed how the poor and working class whites were also disenfranchised, and it's time that we did something to enfranchise all of these groups. So,
yeah. Jack Beatty.
Well, I was going to say, one of the problems, though, is the language. The language that's used is a language of discrimination. And I'm just being discriminated against because of my race. Mm-hmm. Now, the white worker hears that, and he thinks, well, wait a minute. I'm suffering the same disadvantages. They're saying this is a result of their race. I don't see myself in this.
Yeah, but, Jack, we're not talking about discrimination because of race. We are introducing the concept of political race to get away from exactly what you're describing.
And political race is what? Is it class or something else?
No, political race is the idea that you join with other people to change systems of injustice that you have become aware of because you are watching the canary. You are watching what was happening to people of color, and you are using what was happening to understand patterns of injustice. So it starts.
So it's politicized racial awareness, essentially?
Yes. Yes, it's a form of racial literacy. It is not a form of a larger class action suit based on issues of discrimination. This is not about going to court. This is about political action, not litigation.
Jack, how does that sit with you?
Well, it's devoutly to be wished. The history here, though, isn't encouraging, as, of course, Lenny Guinea knows. I mean, in the last election, George W. Bush carried the votes of white men with a high school education or less by 23 points. And from George Wallace on through Bush's father, the white backlash against race consciousness and against the whole language of, you know, my rights are being violated because of my race, rightly or wrongly, has been one of the main veins of sort of reactionary politics in America.
Right. I agree with that.
And what you're saying is, let's just in the destructive element immerse. Let's just get in there and say, look, what's happening to black people is also happening to you.
But we're not saying that you have to get into the destructive element. That's a typical media move, which is that we're going to take what has been polarizing, and then we're going to force you to define yourself in that same polarizing way. We're saying we're trying to take what's been polarizing and tell a different story. The reason it's been polarizing is because the full story has not been told. So let me just give you another example. Proposition 209 was passed in California, mm-hmm. basically eliminating consideration of race and gender in admissions to institutions of higher education as well as other state institutions. And it was passed not by an overwhelming margin, but it passed. At the same time that Proposition 209 passed, which was in 1996, California was spending more money building prisons than it was spending on institutions of higher education. Mm-hmm. Nobody was telling that story, that underlying the frustration that many working class and poor whites had that they were not getting into these institutions of higher education was a fundamental shift in budget resources away from education to prison.
They were getting into an institution somewhere, but not an institution of higher learning. Lonnie Guinier, Jack Beatty, stand by. We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Richard's calling from Buffalo, New York.
Hi, and thank you for accepting my call.
Good to have you, Richard.
Let me have to say that race is an absolute relevant criteria on a personal, community, and a political level.
Why do you say that, Richard?
I've had the opportunity to work within black organizations for the last 10 years and been exposed to a reality that I would suggest that most white people haven't. And on a day-to-day level, the insults and humiliations and institutional questioning is unprecedented and not to be experienced by more majoritarian agencies.
So do you see then, Richard, a logic in Lonnie Guinier's suggestion of rallying around race for a first political step?
I think the idea that as America becomes more diverse, I would expect that you might find people of color beginning to understand that they have a common agenda. I need to add quite quickly, however, that it's American white people who make an issue about race itself, and that white nativism really is the offense. Otherwise, there would be no issue. And while we may have gone around perhaps reflecting September 11th, mm-hmm. Racial profiling, it's white people who do that because we have tinted eyes and don't see very clearly.
Richard, thanks for your call. You remind us that it's a real phenomenon. We want to get one more call before the break. George is calling from Buffalo, New York. Hello, George. You're on the air. Hello, George. Are you there?
Yes.
Hi, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, I have a comment I'd like you to talk about, and that is that I feel that there's only one major way of getting rid of the racial problem, and that's by intermarriage. This is all based on personal experience.
Okay.
In the city of Buffalo, my mother and father got married about 65 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One was from Sicily. The other one was from Calabria. Now, they're very close, but it was almost like mixed races. Since that time, because of intermarriage among nationalities, Polish, German, Irish, English, that's almost been obliterated because you cannot hate a grandchild or a daughter or a son and embrace them as your own.
So, George, we hear that loud and clear, but then what do you make of Lonnie Guinier saying, in the meantime, because that nationally would be a project that could take a long time, we need to embrace and identify around race sometimes to be politically effective?
Well, I definitely feel that what she's saying is absolutely correct because of that the poor whites are in the same boat as many, many blacks.
Mm-hmm. George, thank you very much for your call. Lonnie Guinier, you know something about this. Your own parents, were they not interracial?
Yes, my mother is Jewish. My father was black. He's deceased.
But that hasn't left you without racial issues in your life.
Well, this is really not a project about fixing interpersonal relationships alone. This is really a project about transforming democracy, transforming access to higher education in ways that are fundamentally fair for all people. And we're not saying that people shouldn't intermarry or shouldn't try to get beyond race as individuals. We're really talking about a political project that says that white people right now have no explanation for why they are not realizing the American dream except for race. And we want to use race in a different way that enables them to see how they could realize the American dream if they joined with people of color.
Lonnie Guinier says race can be the X-ray that makes our own country clear to us. Do you agree? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking with Lonnie Guinier about a new view of race. She's got a new book out, The Miner's Canary, Enlisting Race, Resisting Power, Transforming Democracy. Can race be the way, race identification be the way to understanding our country, to a new kind of politics? Lonnie Guinier, your critique is pretty sweeping of the health of American democracy. You say, unless we begin to rethink power, we are going to witness the slow but steady evisceration of American democracy. And you look, to our surprise, 40 years after the Civil Rights Movement, as racial identification is one way of kickstarting greater political awareness, involvement, effectiveness.
Let me make it clear, we're not talking about racial identification in the traditional sense of identity politics or racial nationalism.
But you do talk about racial communities.
Yes. But we are saying that it is important for people of color, A, to feel a sense of solidarity in their critique, in their perspective as to what's happening, and to use that critique to enable and help whites to understand what's also happening in their communities. This is the message, essentially, that agitation around race is a gift that people of color can give to all Americans. Mm-hmm. It is not just special interest pleading.
Jack Beatty?
Ms. Grenade, does this mean that you want to give up on affirmative action? Because, of course, I mentioned earlier the 23-point difference white men with high school educations voting for President Bush. President Bush in the campaign was against affirmative action. Vice President Gore was for it. I think polls would show that, you know, many white working class men feel that affirmative action is a threat to their jobs. And so are you willing, in the name of this political race, to give up on this race-based remedy?
I support affirmative action if nothing else is going to be done. But I think we can do a lot better than affirmative action. So if the choice is to go after the way in which we are admitting everybody and use some of the experiences of affirmative action to inform our critique that what we call merit is actually a proxy for wealth, it does not correlate with the way people are doing in school, and it certainly doesn't predict who's going to be successful after they graduate, who's going to be a leader in their community, that we have to use the experience of exclusion that may appear to affect people of color as a window into changing the way in which we admit everybody, not just people of color, but open up the admission process to start with the mission of institutions of higher education and then strategize backwards to rethink admission for everybody.
Lonnie Guineer, Jack Beatty, standby. I want to try and get a couple more calls in. Carrie is on the line. Welcome, Carrie. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm actually really glad to hear this topic on your program, mm-hmm. And I believe that institutional racism hurts absolutely everybody. And the comment I want to make is actually towards you, Tom.
Yes.
And what I'd like to say is that I think it's extremely detrimental when people talk about racism as a color issue. It's not an issue of someone being a darker color skin or lighter color skin. Racism was founded on the colonization of Africans.
So you're talking, Carrie, about when we're saying, are we done with colorblindness? You don't want the word color in there.
I don't, because I think it's really detrimental, because people tend to think of racism as simply an issue of color. A person's, you know, different color skin, and that's not what racism is about.
Carrie, we got it, and our time is short, and I want to take your good point and turn it to Lonnie Guineer. Lonnie, how does color come in here, or does it come in here? As you talk about people forming communities, identifying to some extent and politically, is Carrie right in saying color has nothing to do with this?
What we're saying is the white people at Kmart who identified with the black workers and said, why weren't we sued too? They were politically raced. They may have been white in terms of their color, but they were politically raced in terms of their behavior.
But this building block, this starting place that you see for racial unity, does color have nothing to do with it?
People can come to this racial unity from many different roads. Color may be one way, but they can also come from experience. They can come from watching the canary. This is about pulling people together to transform America, to make America live up to its greatest hopes for everybody.
You write about color. You even talk about the whiteness of a different color in your book.
And that's about the racial bribe, which may be too complicated in terms of describing. But if anybody is interested, they can read Chapter 7 of the book. It's about the way in which Latinos are in a position right now to accept or reject racial bribe.
Sitting on the line. Let's snag one more call. Harold is on the line. Harold, we've just got a few seconds. Can you make it quick for us?
It'll be very quick.
Thank
bravo,
you.
Bravo. The class struggle is alive and well. You're just using the sunglasses to show us the canary that they didn't see in Europe well over 100 years ago. Am I right?
This is not about struggling only on issues of class. This is about using race to fix injustice that, yes, involves class, but it also involves gender. It also involves power. It involves democracy. And we don't have a language in this country to talk about class. We do have a language to talk about race. We want to interrupt the present conversation and transform it using a very different understanding of race and racism. We're not saying you're a racist if you talk about race. We're saying racism is acquiescing, is accepting distributions of resources along a hierarchy in which people of color are at the bottom and others are given privileges to dominate, and that racism is institutionalized. It's not individualized.
Lonnie Guinier, you write with Gerald Torres, "We are not satisfied with irony, hedonism, or futility as present tense options for progressive social change. Whatever you do to move away from those, we're glad for." Lonnie Guinier, thanks for joining us, and Jack Beattie as well. That's all the time we have tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A poll released today of likely Democratic voters claims that Senator Hillary Clinton of New York has moved significantly closer to being the top choice as the 2004 Democratic presidential nominee. Clinton, just behind Al Gore in this latest Zogby poll, spoke yesterday at Harvard University about global, national, and personal commitment after September 11th. Here is an excerpt of that speech.
In the post-September 11th world, we do have to defend ourselves. We have to be willing to stand for freedom and for the values that we not only hold dear, but which we believe are the birthright of every human being. You can read about them in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. I happen to think they're universal. Different cultures and different societies at different points of time can make a different choice about how human beings should live and what kind of political systems should govern them. But it is clear to me that the universal values at the root of our political system, embodied in the Declaration of Human Rights that nations sign off on whether they follow them or not, are worth fighting for and worth dying for. But we also have to recognize that part of America's greatness is in widening the circle of opportunity around the world, in creating conditions for more boys and girls to feel that they too can have a future that gives them the chance to live up to their God-given potential. That is why I think while we are investing more in our military, while we are rightfully investing more in our homeland security, we should also be investing in more in development aid, more in family planning, more in education for girls and boys, more in health care, more in the kinds of tasks and activities that will help to create opportunity around the world. And we have to do a better job of explaining who we are. Who is this great, unmatched superpower? Well, we are the nation that went to war for Muslims in Bosnia and Kosovo. We are the nation that has tried repeatedly to create regimes around the world that would pay more attention to human rights, sometimes being told we had no business talking about freedom of religion, freedom of the press, freedom of conscience. At the same time, we know that in our own country, we cannot turn only toward defending ourselves abroad and worrying about the problems in the rest of the world. We have to make sure that we put our values into practice every day. We do have a lot of challenges that are still not being met. The biggest may be our turn away from fiscal responsibility, which will eventually undermine our capacity to be strong at home and abroad. It does not make any sense for us to try to pay for the war, which is getting extremely expensive, make ourselves more secure at home, and believe that we can continue to implement the tax cuts. The world has changed since last spring, and we should have leadership that recognizes that and calls all of us, particularly the richest among us, to sacrifice. It is only right and fair. And while I will support putting the kind of investments we need into that kind of security, we not only have to worry about national security and homeland security, but we should also be working for economic security, homeland energy security, homeland health security, homeland environment security. When we talk about security today, we should be preparing to build the kind of future where our children are secure to go outside and play without having to worry about the environment, where every man and woman who goes to work doesn't have to worry about their Social Security, their Medicare, or their pensions being taken away from them, and where we all understand that part of our responsibility today is to demonstrate to ourselves and the rest of the world that we want to create the fairer, safest, strongest, smartest, and yes, richest country we can, not only for us to enjoy, but to spread the blessings that come from freedom to everyone willing to be responsible in our own country and around the world.
Hillary Clinton at Harvard University. Jack Beatty, you heard the poll numbers that I cited just before she came on, saying that she's now seen as a very strong potential presidential candidate in 2004. Do you hear a presidential voice there?
Well, it certainly had that presidential sort of lift to it, didn't it?
Yeah, there seems to be, she seems to be a leaning into the notion.
And the phrase economic security, health security, environmental security, this is that we haven't heard these phrases in some time. On the one hand, she says that we need to invest in these things, and need to invest in the war on terror, and need to invest in foreign aid and development aid. And then she gets right up to it, and she says, and we can't continue on with these tax cuts and maintain fiscal responsibility plus do all this other spending. Now, does this mean she's willing to join with Senator Kennedy, who's made a very sane proposition, to simply delay the tax cuts on the wealthiest Americans, that they will get some tax cuts, but not all of them, until our budget situation and the war on terror is paid? That the test of this will be if she's willing to join him in that very sound policy.
And even beyond that, you do hear the beginnings here of a potential Democratic rejoinder to George Bush as the next presidential election emerges. She, as you say, she's expanding the definition of homeland security to include the Democratic agenda.
She really is, and she's aiming it right at things where Bush is vulnerable. I mean, there isn't going to be a prescription drug benefit, apparently. We just don't have enough money. People are at their livelihoods, their pensions are at risk, and we have this environmental crisis, and it's getting worse under Bush. So, yeah, I think she's really touched on the core Democratic issues and put the word security in front of them.
Mm-hmm. We can't pay for the war, needs at home, and tax cuts, says Hillary Clinton. Well, there's a voice to keep track of. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from School Chimbachari, Michael Garth, Tim Skog, and Isabella Tabarovsky. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.